Welcome to the Washington AI Network podcast. I'm Tammy Haddad, the founder of the Washington AI Network, where we bring together official Washington policymakers, DC insiders, and AI experts who are challenging, debating, and just trying to figure out the rules of the road for artificial intelligence. Welcome to Paris. Yes, we are in Paris for the European Network of Women in Leadership Conference. We were at the Elysee Palace earlier, but we couldn't leave town without checking in with our great American representatives. And we have two amazing ambassadors here with us today to talk about AI. They're dealing with issues that the whole world is trying to figure out, and it's so great to have them here. Courtney O'Donnell is ambassador to UNESCO, and that's the United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. It's a specialized agency of the UN promoting world peace security through international cooperation in education, arts, sciences, and culture. And former Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney, now ambassador to OECD, the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. Now, you have 38 member countries. You guys are in the same building, very close to the ambassador, Denise Bauer. But I want to talk to you both about AI. That's why we're here. Sean, do you want to go first and talk about the mission of OECD? Because we have a lot of scientists here who may not have focused on the work you're doing here.
Yeah, of course. Well, first, it's great to be with you, as always, Tammy. Thank you for your kind words. The OECD, as we call it, is an international organization, actually has its roots in the Marshall Plan after World War II, and it was the vehicle through which we distributed the resources involved in the Marshall Plan to help rebuild Europe. In the decades since, it has become a global organization of the world's leading democracies. And so it's a very important forum where we can work with like-minded countries to advance our shared economic interests. We are known for our research. I believe we publish about 600 publications each year. It's hard to pick up the Wall Street Journal or the Financial Times without seeing OECD data, typically on comparative economic data. We do a lot of important international tax work. We do a lot of important work on anti-bribery around the world. We do a lot of important work now on artificial intelligence and other issues of mutual concern.
And how many member countries are there?
There are 38 countries. There are eight more seeking to join the OECD. What unites them is a shared commitment to democracy, the rule of law, human rights. So really, these are our best partners and friends around the world.
Very fascinating. Now, Courtney, there you are on the other side of the building. I love the fact that you two are here together in the same building. So talk to us about UNESCO and the efforts.
Absolutely. Thanks again for making the time to come today to our shared offices. It's wonderful to see you in Paris. And I think UNESCO was also formed after World War II, in the ashes of World War II, with the goal of trying to form bonds among peoples using arts, science, and culture to bring people together. So that manifests itself in many ways, but UNESCO plays a strong role in shaping the norms and standards of education around the world. Many people know UNESCO for the work around the world to save and protect unique cultural heritage sites through their World Heritage Program. But the reach, as you think about science, education, culture, are incredibly vast. And we also are, amongst UNESCO, 194 member countries, as well as 12 associate members. It's a space for convening a really broad and diverse group of member states. And as Ambassador Maloney said, when you're looking at such wide topics, artificial intelligence is no doubt impacting all of them. So when we think about the American presence at UNESCO, similar to the American presence at OECD, you know, we really believe strongly American leadership and an American voice shaping these discussions specifically on emerging technologies like AI is critical.
Well, this is not your first technology job, I would say. You've had a lot of experience in tech as well as government. So you're looking at AI, and you guys have written some reports. And I know you have a very large global team who have spent a lot of time focusing on how to make things fair. Where are things?
Well, it's a great question because at UNESCO, there are a lot of reports that are written, and we joke in the world of AI, the moment they hit the printer, they're out of date because obviously AI is moving so rapidly and it's an incredibly iterative process. But I think what really is at the core of the U.S. presence at UNESCO is ensuring that these technologies are based around a human-centered, human rights-based approach. And I know you know very well, Tammy, the work of the 2023 Presidential Executive Order around AI, safe, trustworthy, how we make sure that we bring those ideals and those values to this forum. And when you have 194 countries, there's a vast array of maturity or, you know, where countries are in terms of the infrastructure, the investment, the technology. And so some countries are just at a point where they're grappling with, should we have a national standard or approach for AI? Others are very mature and thinking about very specific growth strategies across sectors. And so we think it's really important to be at that table because, as you know, in America, we believe AI can advance sustainable development and that all countries on their journey can benefit from what we've developed around safe, secure, and trustworthy AI. So I would say the conversations are frequent. They really go across all sectors. And what we've tried to do from the point of view of our mission is really think about how we can share best practices, partner with other countries to bring them along, and also bring our best and brightest talent from technology, education, and other sectors to the table here at these multilateral organizations.
I'm going to come back to you because I want to ask you about the cooperation because I find it fascinating with this Washington AI Network past year, how much global cooperation there is. But Sean, I want to turn to you because you're dealing with the economics, the finance. And as you pointed out, it's all the data. How do you spread that data around the world and get countries to not necessarily work together, but at least start at the same level?
One of the differences between the different fora that the United States is active in on this subject, here two are represented, the UN system, and UNESCO, Courtney's beat, which is really effectively universal membership. The OECD is, by definition, a more specific membership around like-mindedness and our values. And so I start that way for your question on data, because so much of our interest as we try to benefit from these extraordinary technological innovations and revolution that AI represents is to enshrine our values in that. And really, when you think about it, the only way to avoid the downsides of AI, which are real, is to enshrine your values in the systems that AI is built on. And what we are able to do on data and on other issues at OECD is get together with the countries who really share our values and to work on issues of inclusivity that open up the opportunities of AI globally, but that also have deeply rooted within them the values of human rights and of free expression and of obviously just accuracy, historical accuracy. The United States is very focused on both spreading the benefits of AI, but also making sure that it is, as Courtney points out, safe and reliable. I don't want to talk about a UN initiative, but the Secretary of State recently traveled to New York and made an announcement at the General Assembly, which is just the latest effort. I think it was a $100 million commitment to spread the technology more globally, specifically to support the computing that's required for effective AI to more countries, to open up some of the models, to have more local context and language, because, of course, the data has to be inclusive of people's different languages, different cultures, different nuances and sensitivities. And that's a very important effort, and that will require leadership and resources. So I think those are the kind of areas where we really do some great work, not just to advance American interests, but to make sure that the benefits of AI are widely spread.
And the other issue with AI on the table every day is the use of energy. When you look at the world, so many of the geopolitical issues are based on energy. And then you overlay AI. So how do you take the energy piece and talk to countries about that?
Well, one of the things people may not realize is that the International Energy Association is also based here in Paris and actually grew out of the OECD around the oil embargo and the energy crisis in the 1970s. And some of the most important work we do on international energy policy is actually done through the IEA, the International Energy Agency, again, a sort of nested entity within OECD. And so you're absolutely right, because we can't lose sight of our energy transition goals. We can't lose sight of the climate crisis. And that's why the energy conversation is inextricably linked to the AI conversation, because people may not realize that this is not like doing a search on Google and it's the same amount of electricity you're using as doing other types of computing. To do the type of computing required here on these large models requires enormous amounts of energy because of the number of calculations. And so that's why the conversation around sustainability and of having sustainable sources of energy and having those resources available to all peoples in all countries, you cannot separate it from a serious conversation about how to accomplish both these goals and the other important goals that we have to achieve as well.
Well, also, France, you're here where nuclear energy is primary, and the rest of the world doesn't really have that, especially in the United States. So maybe that will change soon. We'll see. So, Courtney, how does the U.S. work on AI at UNESCO?
Well, in a variety of ways. And I think hopping on to what Ambassador Maloney said, because we really love our acronyms in this space too. But I think when we talk about climate on the UNESCO side, we are not on as much the technical expertise or necessarily recommending very specific regulatory matters, but thinking about broadly, how do you use science to advance such goals, the utilization of AI and science and monitoring? Part of UNESCO is the International Oceanographic Committee and the Intergovernmental Hydrological Program, the IHP, where we see it's using AI to monitor water and resources. So some of the greatest science and climate-based initiatives that have been core to UNESCO's work and have involvement of great American universities and scientists are now implementing AI into their ongoing work. And I think as we talk about the broad range of where different member states are on AI, we do a lot of work as the U.S. mission partnering. We are the co-chair, along with Ghana, of the Priority Friends of Africa group. And really, we think about President Biden today in Angola talking about the future is here in Africa. And so a lot of the work we do in that space is thinking about how can we advance digital skills, look at AI and models that may have worked in the United States, or to Ambassador Maloney's points, ways we can help spearhead some of that innovation. Because while we're thinking about certain things, my colleague from Nigeria is saying we still need to get better STEM education programs. We still have rural populations who we're afraid aren't going to benefit from this tremendous technology. So I think trying to ensure American leadership is, again, basing the work we're doing across all sectors in this safe, secure, human rights-based approach, but also ensuring as the technology lifts, it lifts everyone up, and that the sustainable development goals that are embedded within the UN system, that the benefits are shared equally. And I think we take that very seriously in these multilateral engagements.
There's so much money and there's so much time spent on health, global health, and especially with developing countries. I wonder, Sean, if you have looked at the health effects or the health inequities in AI.
You know, it's obviously one of the best examples that people should understand about the upside here, what the opportunities are. It's easy to get focused on some of the risks and downsides. I recently learned about a program in India where using AI tools, you can cough basically next to your phone. And by the sound of your cough, the AI program can diagnose tuberculosis. And they've already had hundreds of millions of people participate in this program to eradicate that disease in India. So it's just one example of how exciting these tools are and the incredible diagnostic possibilities. And again, as you point out, the data is so key, being able to do better diagnosing earlier of things like tumors or cancers. There's huge opportunities here. So I should probably back up and tell you that we brought together something called the Global Partnership on AI, integrating OECD's efforts with what before that was an effort called GPAI, the Global Partnership on AI, that had grown out of a G7 meeting some years ago, I believe in Canada. And what this does is it creates an integrated partnership where we'll do some of the most exciting international work on AI policy, because what OECD really has that others don't is thousands of technical experts who have the former secretariat capable of supporting the substantive technical policy work here. But also it creates greater inclusion by including non-OECD countries in the effort through a balanced partnership. And that's really being stood up right now. And so some of the key areas where we will focus, we have a conference next week on AI and work, AI and education, and healthcare is absolutely one of the areas where I think we will see revolutionary advances. But again, you know, you got to get the rules of the road right, and you got to make sure your values are embedded in this. And so it really matters that the people who share our values in as inclusive a way as possible, that we create a system where we can benefit in healthcare and other areas from these incredible technologies, but we don't put at risk our security, our values, our freedoms, because those downsides are real too.
How much time have both of you spent allaying fears about AI?
A great amount. I think it's a great question, and it's very real. And that's why I think education is so important. And I know both of us work very closely with U.S. corporations, members of the U.S. academic community, U.S. experts and technicians, partially as an education to other member states. But the fears are real. There's often a focus on the risk, and rightly so. We need to be very cautious. But I think also we can see the potential for huge gains where it's vastly needed. But there's no question trying to demystify fears and enhance education from procurement to data to privacy. We think about students and teachers a lot at UNESCO, given the focus on education. There's a lot of opportunity, but a lot of questions. And it's changing so rapidly that we really need to be careful.
And the thing I've seen is that if you talk to technologists, you have a high-level conversation about AI, the fears you typically hear about are the, you know, the science fiction movie of AI taking over the world, or of automated systems doing things that humans can't stop. And those concerns are, believe it or not, actually real, and we have to be careful. Actually, though, here in the settings, and Ambassador O'Donnell may have found the same thing, the biggest fear I hear is the fear of being left out, is the fear that this is going to be a technology that inures to the benefit of wealthy countries, of countries that have the energy, that have the models, that have the companies that can lead in this space. And so part of what we do well, I think, in our engagements here in these multilateral settings is that we really walk the walk of showing that we're going to do better if we do this together with as many partners and friends as we can have. And of course, we're going to look out for American economic interests, certainly in my role. But, you know, there's that expression, if you want to go fast, go alone. But if you want to go far, go together. And that is very true in AI. And the biggest fear I've found, and from some countries you might not expect, we're not just talking about the developing world. We're talking about some very powerful and wealthy countries, but who have real insecurities that this technology is going to benefit the United States alone, or it's going to benefit only certain countries in certain ways. And that's just not true, and especially not true if we do it right. And we're all going to be better off if we get it right working together.
To Ambassador Maloney's point, I think there is a great fear that the stereotypes that currently exist, the misinformation that currently exists, that given the sheer force and power of AI, that can be amplified, whether it's across employment opportunities or for journalists who already face a lot of danger, are now facing it online for students. And so I think the intentionality, and that is what America brings to the table in these forums. When we're leading a resolution, as we did at our recent executive board on AI, it's about sustainable development. It's about integrating. It's about human rights based, but recognizing we need to be really intentional about the areas of challenge. But I was recently on a panel with diplomats from Japan, the EU, Nigeria, Brazil, and everyone is grappling with these questions. And so these forums, I think, really give us opportunities to learn from each other, share challenges and opportunities, and hopefully get to a place where we make strides together on some of those shared goals.
It's interesting because so many people will talk about how government isn't helping, how not just the U.S. government, but you name it, citizens think, oh, no one cares about me, especially when you're talking about AI, just to the point of harms. And it's interesting because all the technologists feel like there's so much time being spent by institutions like yours and other institutions, not this year, not last year, not since ChatGPT came out. Like, how long have both of your institutions been working on it? At least 5 years, right?
Even longer.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think people would be surprised to know that some of the early work was done at OECD in 2019 around principles governing AI, and that's foundational work that still serves as a key guidepost to some of the areas where we're working on these issues. And so, yeah, this has been going on for longer than people think, but it's still just getting going.
I was just talking to the climate solutions person at Hugging Face, and it made me think the amount of opportunities on that side of the coin, anything you do in climate that can make a difference. We've already talked about energy. Is there anything you're seeing specifically on the climate side that you think AI is helping make a big difference?
I would say from the OECD perspective, we have countries that are largely participating in other international efforts like the Paris Climate Agreement who have very serious programs in place to try to decarbonize their economies. Obviously, we've done enormously important work on this in the United States in the last few years, the Inflation Reduction Act and other measures where the Biden administration has really led on climate. And I think what AI opens up is the possibility that you can just accelerate these efforts through better modeling, through better technologies, through better identifying ways in which you can decarbonize while you maintain robust economic growth, right, which is the key. And so we don't do the technology. We don't do the actual application layer of AI, but what we're doing is we're creating almost like an international operating system where that application level can run in a way that is safe and reliable and trustworthy. That's why you got to get done consistent with your values and in time to do you some good. And I think all of us who lived through the internet revolution, I think now have a more nuanced understanding of the upsides and downsides of that incredible revolution, right? I mean, all of our kids are being affected one way or another by social media. That's not something we thought about in the early days of the internet revolution. We thought about all of the wonders and possibilities. So I think it's just a good example as we approach AI of how getting the values right, getting the system set up the right way is really going to pay benefits in climate and in other areas. And that's really the work we're doing anyway.
I'm going to mention Congress again because it's watching the process as they've been trying to consider legislation. And there's a couple members who think that instead of watermarking synthetic material, that original material should be what's watermarked, or there should be some sort of international standard. Are you seeing on either side of the fence that any country or anyone you've talked to along the way that you think is finding a way to authenticate materials that will make people feel safer? This is for real. My kid will see it. Have you seen anything along the way?
Part of the principles that are at the heart of the work the EU has done on this here in Europe are around that sort of transparency and auditability. And then, of course, depending on where and how that's showing up, you care more or less, right? The risks get more acute in certain areas. If you see the president of the United States on video, you should be able to know it is actually the president of the United States speaking. In other areas, you may be less concerned. And so I think you'll see that at the heart of most of the regulatory efforts on this. U.S. has taken a slightly more hands-off approach, a more innovation-based approach, which is often our preferred way to go. But yeah, this is coming. This is coming fast. You're going to have to know when that information is real, when it's your spouse calling on the phone, or whether it's an AI-generated voice that you cannot distinguish from your own spouse. And
at UNESCO, we see that a lot on the education side in terms of how are we thinking about digital literacy, digital learning, both for teachers, for parents, for students, to be smarter about sources and to really question that. And so how does that manifest itself in different curricula? How do you ensure textbooks are inclusive? How do you ensure they're credible? These were questions that happened with hard textbooks, and now you think about the diversity there. And then I do think to flip again to positives, when you talk about Hugging Face, UNESCO has done some great work with Hugging Face around preserving indigenous languages through AI, and you think about who's in the room, what are we using, what are the data sets, language, doing pretty well for English, but think about the languages that are going extinct as we sit here and the opportunity to utilize these tools on a human, on a cultural level to really advance and preserve these assets. Just this week, we're heading into Notre Dame being reconstructed after a devastating fire, and we've met with companies and architects that AI is a part of preserving, rebuilding. How can that be used in places like Ukraine, in places that are experiencing devastation of cultural artifacts, or being able to share that with people who otherwise wouldn't get to travel? And so back to finding the various ways that we are working with partners across sectors to utilize this for good, there are a lot of really exciting multilateral opportunities.
You mentioned Notre Dame, and I was with Dara from Autodesk, and she told the story of how they used AI. If you think about building, if you're building with 3D, it changes everything. And she described how they did it. And when you think about the implications, not for Notre Dame, but for housing, all the housing crisis issues globally, that if you can use AI and you can get faster answers and better answers, you've solved one of the biggest problems taking place in the world, including in the United States. So you're going to be here for a few more months. Are you writing a note of here's all the things AI can fix after you leave? You're going to leave a note for President Macron. Here's what we see. Maybe it's, 3D. Anything you've seen here in Paris? Because I was reminded today that it is a hub of scientific education at the highest level. Is there anything you've seen here other than really what you talked about in India, which seems remarkable?
I think people should realize that France actually has a pretty robust AI community here. And as an American, I will agree with you that the most exciting work is often done by American companies, but that's pretty familiar to us. I think the French would be pleased if we mentioned that they actually have been a real leader on AI, and they're well positioned on that. And one of the reasons is because they rely on nuclear energy, as you pointed out. And so the climate impacts of doing large data centers here or other infrastructure side pieces of the AI ecosystem have different impacts and favorable ones climate-wise. But really on the technical side, yeah, they have some really cool companies here doing some really interesting work, often on smaller models and on some of the things that they might have a more strategic advantage on, or comparative advantage on, I guess you'd say. And they were also one of the early leaders on the global partnership on AI together with Canada. They really stood that up, those two nations. And now, as I mentioned, it's been joined up with OECD. And while it's still called GPI, it's really GPI 2.0, because now it includes all 38 countries in the OECD, plus a bunch of others, including India and other major nations who are participating in that global policy work. So France has been a leader on this.
Absolutely. I would agree. And I think we both feel fortunate to be here in such a rich environment where there is so much innovation. And also just the notion of convening. I think we both spend a lot of our times in convenings that happen at our respective headquarters at OECD and UNESCO, which is really important to share information, to understand the best practices, to really hear where people are in their journey. To your point, to how do we dispel fears? How do we ensure there are more women at the table? Rural populations, whether you're in Nigeria or Nepal, there are ways we can learn from each other. And so being able to be a part of these convenings that our organizations foster with such expertise and a desire to get to impact is really gratifying and really exciting.
Well, I always feel like leading from the front is the key. And both of you are doing that. I can't tell you how much it means to me personally to have you representing the United States here in France. Although I'm happy to have you come back. I look forward to that.
At some point. We might leave our jobs, but Paris is pretty great.
Yeah. It's great to hear the amount of work you're doing in AI and for the United States and all of these countries. Thank you for being with us on the Washington AI Network podcast. Thank you for listening to the Washington AI Network podcast. Be sure to subscribe and join the conversation. The Washington AI Network is a bipartisan forum bringing together the top leaders and industry experts to discuss the biggest opportunities and the greatest challenges around AI. The Washington AI Network podcast is produced and recorded by Haddad Media. Thanks for listening.